Our Untangled Minds by CUSM is for informational purposes only and does not constitute professional medical or psychological advice, diagnosis, and or treatment. Please make sure if you do have any questions or concerns that are medical or psychological in nature that you seek out a physician or qualified mental health provider for further help. Furthermore, the information, viewpoints, or opinions expressed in this podcast are solely the views of the individuals that are involved. They do not represent absolute fact and are subject to change at any point in time. CUSM does not accept responsibility for these views. Lastly, the names and details of any medical stories shared in this episode have been edited for privacy.
What do you know about alternative medicine? Do you have a family member, a friend, a neighbor, someone in your life who uses herbal supplements? What is the role of a physician in caring for the patients who want to use alternative medicine?
If any of those topics interest you, today's topic will be about cultural humility, respect, and being able to integrate the alternative methods into the evidence-based care that you'll be practicing as a physician.
Welcome to another episode of Our Untangled Minds. My name is Kyle Rye, and I will be one of your hosts today.
And my name is Sabrina Nguyen, and I'll be another host.
Today, we are meeting with a very special guest. We have Dr. Mashriki. We know him as our clinical skills teacher, but previously, he was a trauma surgeon who served in Angola, and what we'd like to talk about today is the role of integrative medicine in war, how to care for patients, how to gain their trust, how to show cultural humility, how to get better outcomes for patients. So just to get us started, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe your educational background, your training?
Hi, everybody. My name is Imad Mashriki. I finished my medical degree in Egypt, and it was a full British education. By that time, it was King's College, and that the level we were working with. And then I finished my postgraduate surgery diplomat also in Egypt. And then I started practice surgery and a bit of trauma surgery in Egypt. And then came the time when I went to Angola and did trauma surgery. And then after that, I practiced surgery in multiple places. I did work with Germans for 5 years. And then I came here in the United States and a happy member of CUSM faculty.
So can you paint a picture of where you were stationed, what that was like in Angola?
When I went to Angola, the contract was supposed to be just a trauma surgery, but it was supposed to be in the main cities, like close to the capital. And when I went there, I discovered that they have a very huge shortage, and they told me, no, you are going to a province called Lunda Norte, which is northeast of Angola, like right by the borders of Zaire. I believe it's the Congo right now. And there, when I arrived there, it was a station basically serving as first-line responder to war trauma, because we were about a couple of kilometers away from an open war line between the two fighting forces. And basically, we had supplies coming from the government sometimes, or Doctors Without Borders would give us something from Zaire. And there was basically nothing except the hospital, a building where we live in, and another building that they have something called, they call the cantina, where we eat, and a squashed playground, like a racquetball, and a swimming pool. That's all the life we had. And then try to order food for a couple of months. I did not know that they speak Portuguese. They told me, it's okay, you speak English and French fluently, you'll be okay. In the airport in Luanda, I discovered they speak Portuguese. So try to order food, 3 meals a day for 2 months in a language you don't speak. It was like a comedy show, but, you know, literally.
So when you were out there, who exactly was on your healthcare team?
We had a team of doctors from everywhere. Most of the nurses were local from Angola, mostly from the local tribe that we were living among, the Chakwe tribe. Doctors were from Portugal, from Cuba, Peru, Uruguay, Paraguay. So I had to learn Spanish to talk with the doctors, and Portuguese to talk with somebody, with everybody else, and a little bit of Chakwe to talk to patients, because some of them don't even speak Portuguese.
And what was that population that you were serving like? How many different cultures were within it?
Angola have 7 big tribes, and every tribe has their own local language. So where I was in the northeast, there was the Chokwe tribe. There is the Kikongo, the Kimbundu, Imbundu, Lingala, and a couple more that I don't remember. But each one of those had their own language. And other than that was the soldiers that were in the whether in the army, the official, like the Angolan army, or the rebels that were there. And those were from everywhere.
So I'm trying to keep track of the languages that you just brought up. What would a typical patient interaction look like if they spoke only Chokwe? You weren't quite fluent in Portuguese yet, but you said that you knew French. How would that go?
Now, thinking back about it, I'm imagining this in one of our clinical skills or OSCE. Me, it would be a hilarious comedy show. It will take, you have the 18 minutes for the encounter. It would take 15 minutes to know who is this guy and what he wants. Literally. Because I was speaking French at that time. And I had a nurse who speak French and Portuguese. And if the patient does not speak Portuguese, we had another person who speak Portuguese and Chokwe. And we had to go all the way back and forth. So who are you? What are you here for? What's your name? What can I call you? Date of birth? What's your chief complaint? There's will be like a good 10, 15 minutes there. So that was painful. But then I learned Portuguese, and then I learned some of the important Chokwe words so I could communicate with them fast in their own language.
And what about communicating with the doctors? You said you learned Portuguese or you learned Spanish to communicate?
I learned both of them. I had to learn Portuguese and then I had to learn Spanish because the surgeon, the second only, we were only 2 surgeons. The second surgeon was from Peru and the rest of the team was from Portugal, Uruguay, and I had to learn Spanish to communicate with them too.
Wow. Okay. So in total, how many languages do you speak?
Well, Arabic, which is my home language in Egypt, with a couple of dialects, actually 2 or 3 dialects fluently. English, British and American, French, Portuguese, with some Brazilian and Portuguese accent, like the accent to Portugal and the dialect of Brazil, and Spanish. And I know some of the old Greek, Coptic, like a mix of the hieroglyphic and Greek.
So you know how to read hieroglyphs?
No, I know how to read the Greek because it's the Coptic language is written in Greek alphabet. So I know how to read the Greek alphabet. And it helped in medicine, by the way, because the knowledge of Latin and Greek, when you see a lot of words, you will know where that word came from. Why did they call it that way? I didn't mean to, but it did help.
That is super impressive.
Yeah.
So when it came to the population that you were working with, did you notice that they had maybe different beliefs when it came to Western medicine? I mean, what opinions do you think that they held?
Totally. They had zero belief or trust in the Western medicine. You can tell when I started to understand, we started to translate for me what they say. They believe that one of the Western doctors, and for them, I was a Western person, even though I'm from Egypt, which means I'm from Africa. But for them, if I'm north of the Sahara, then I'm Western. And they would, like somebody is coming with a lot of trauma to the arm or the leg. And so they believe if you go to them, they will just cut off your limb. They wouldn't treat you. They had that very strong belief, and it took some time to gain their trust.
Was there any like specific alternative medicines that they practiced that you had to learn in order to treat them better?
I did a lot. And again, I got submerged into it without meaning to. We were waiting for our medicine to come with airplanes. There was no way it can go from the land without war. So if the war was so, the bombing was heavy, they would ground all the flights and we would run out of medicine. The only way we could get real medicine is that we connect with the Doctors Without Borders from Zaire, whom they spoke French with me. And they would give me some, but if that's not possible, then we totally run out. So when that happened once and I was completely stuck, the people there suggested, like the local nurses that were from the Chokwe tribe, to go to the medicine man. And at first and I had a smirk on my face, like, yeah, whatever. And went there, and the guy shocked me with a word. He said, if teaching you will help you help my people, then yes, I will teach you. And okay, I respect that. But he gave me some stuff that, like, you know, for me at first, when you clean your backyard, the part that goes to the trash, not the part that stays on the ground, that's what he gave me. Cook this, that's for abdominal pain. You cook this and crush it and give it for us, like, dude, come on. Yeah, okay. Yes, sir. And I was planning that when I go to the hospital, I'll just trash it. Like, yeah, whatever, just be respectful to him. But when I went back there, the people there, oh, you went to him? Thank you. That's really nice of you. I was like, why is that such a big deal? And what is this anyway? Till the Portuguese doctor, who was an orthopedician, he told me, no, you don't understand. He's right. And he gave me some of that botany medicine, the medicinal plants, a book, and tell, here is the references. Here's what he's talking about. Study it, read it. He's right. To discover that what he told me to cook, simmer, and give them for abdominal pain was a belladonna leaf, which is how we get the atropine. So he was right. And then that thing that looked like that part that goes to the trash, that was ergot alkaloid, and that's how we get the codeine sulfate. And I started to learn that the joint pain, he was giving me ginger, and it's okay, that guy makes sense. And I started to use it. And when the people saw that I'm using that with them, and I told them, we ran out of medicine, but I went to your local medicine guy and he gave me this. So we're using it after surgery to help with. And they appreciated this a lot because they saw that I'm not dismissing their culture, but I'm actually learning from it. And it was a huge learning experience that up to now, I'm using some of the stuff that I learned from this guy.
Coming from the West, it's hard to listen to this idea that people think that doctors are going to come and just haphazardly cut off limbs. Like they're there to hurt people or something like that. And what I'm wondering is, where do you think that these beliefs come from? Where do these fears originate? Did you ever have conversations with people out there where they sat down and explained this to you?
I don't know exactly, but what I believe from what I saw is it's that they cross-pointing thinking, the cross-pointing of their thinking, they think that their colonization was from Portugal. So for them, that was bad. Then anything that come from there, from that area, is going to be to exploit them. And they are a very rich country in resources, but they believe that they are being used and abused, which was true. But they don't think that, or they don't know that medicine is something else, that people who practice medicine have another culture in their mind, another set of mind, but they had that like standoffish attitude with anything that is not like them. And what made it more prominent is the attitude of the people talking to them. A lot of the people, or a lot of doctors, or a lot of the medical personnel who were not native in the country, they would talk to them in medicine with the attitude of, listen to me or get out and die. And that would make them, gave them the reason to be standoffish about what these guys are saying.
So then based on that, when you decided that you would learn about their culture, show an open-mindedness, and you did start to treat them with their remedies, do you feel like that kind of opened the door to them being open-minded to maybe the types of treatments that you're more familiar with, or to maybe increase compliance with what you would ordinarily recommend for them?
Completely. That experience definitely made me a better doctor and a better human being altogether, because it's totally different. And the idea of it is they saw that I am willing to learn. Because I went to this guy again and told him, okay, the medicine that you gave me is beautiful, learning, and can you please teach me? because I run out of medicine a lot. They don't get the supplies. I need to help these people, and I don't have the medicine. So I was, okay, I'll teach you. And he started to show me a lot of stuff. Then when the people saw that I am using parts of what they use, and I'm like basically endorsing it as a valid treatment, that gave them the feeling that, okay, he cares about us. And not just the medicine that these, like, when we used to, like, run out of stretchers when we were moving the soldiers, I learned a way that it's so simple, but it's so good that I don't know if you would ever believe that it works. It does. They would get two jackets or two lab coats, put the sleeve inside, and get two big branches of trees and pass it through the sleeves inside. Unbutton these lab coats, and the last buttons in each coat, they will tie it into the other coat and get some to make them tie to each other. And then get some of these things that looks like ropes or something from the trees and tie the middle. And there you go, you have a stretcher. And they would do 100 of those. You want stretchers? I'll get you some. How many you want? And we have no. Doctor, do you want stretchers? I said, yes, I need 6. Okay. Give me a few minutes.
That's amazing.
And they would come with a set of, whoa. And then splints. You want to splint a fracture, one joint above, one joint below. They would, again, get some of these two big branches of trees, like solid ones, two of them, to put them on two sides. And they make the base from banana leaves. And they get, again, these ropes and tie it and put the position that the doctor want to put it at. And then they wrap it with some of these soft things that comes from the plants that is like foamy a little, and they put banana leaves on it, and there you go, you got your cast.
That's amazing.
So yeah, a lot of these, and the burn, when you get wounds, like the superficial burn or wound and so on, we don't have any creams for burns and so, no problem, we got this. And then they showed me how they do it. They get the cactus, that those thick ones that has the gel material inside,
right? Aloe vera?
The aloe vera.
Mm-hmm.
And they would cut the bark outside, and they get that gel part that we get aloe vera from, and they just paint the whole area with it, and they get people, the plants on it, and cover it, the banana leaves and so, and there you go, you got your burn bandage. And it works. It worked. And they even used it to minimize the keloid formation, because a lot of them are keloid formers, and that does decrease the keloid formation, provided you put it before the wound heals. And it did work. So they would come and tell me, can I be using the aloe vera? Can I use the, like, they don't know it, aloe vera. Can I use that plant? And they give me the plant. Can I use this for that wound? I said, yeah, sure, absolutely. But then add to it this antibiotic. Here's this cream, put what you're doing and add to it that. So they see that I'm helping them, not just debating and dismissing what they want. And it was definitely a great experience, a learning experience for me more than them.
So I know you did a great job at like integrating their practices with the Western medicine, even like the antibiotics. So what do you think would have happened if you didn't do that? Like if you didn't integrate any of their practices into the care that you gave them?
I would believe that the way they used to talk about the team before, which is they call them together, o corpo medico, like medical corp, or, you know, no corpo medico, and they wouldn't care to communicate with them. They go to them when it's a life and death situation, they cannot help it. Otherwise, they will do their stuff, and they will get the word from the doctor. But then they go back to their family and people and say, he told me to do this. And no, just get that and we will give you other stuff. And they would, so the compliance to the treatment was horrible. But that link, when that link came and they started to trust me as one who really wants to help, the compliance was 100%. Like they would just do whatever I tell them to do to treat themselves.
So previously we were talking about this a little bit, and you said that you even got invited to some weddings kind of over time as you were living there. What did that timeline look like? And did you notice like a gradual change in the interactions that you had with your patients once you became kind of part of their community?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I got invited to a lot of weddings and celebrations. I got invited to a party that made by the chief of the tribe, Chokwe, because I saved his son. He got two bullets in his abdomen, and I removed two bullets out of him, sealed some few holes in his intestine. And thankfully, by the third, fourth day, the guy was eating. Little boy was eating. He was like 10, 11.
Did you know going into it that that was the chief's son?
No. He was just a patient. He was a patient. Yeah. I don't, like a patient who got a bullet, I'll take it out. That's no big deal. But then the people came and they like big, like collect seven people. And they dressed differently than anybody. And they told me, you have to accept whatever he says. This is the big chief of the Chokwe tribe. Just say yes. And he invited me to a dinner on the honor of, okay, we went and had the nurse that was with me, a guy who was from that tribe, to translate because they don't speak even Portuguese. So in there, and they had a beautiful dinner with, the, by the way, the best Bordeaux, French Bordeaux wine. Le vin de Bordeaux, like you never tasted it. I don't know how they get it. And they discovered later they get it from Zaire, from across the border. And a fish that was so beautiful. Or so I thought. And then wanted to use the bathroom. And the guy told me, what bathroom? Just pass through that tent and there is an area there. We call it bathroom. Go. On the way back, I saw two cobra snakes skinned. So I went back to this nurse, the guy who translates for me. He said, what are these cobra snakes? And he told me in Portuguese, like, this is what you just ate. I said, no, I ate fish. I said, no, that's not fish. In the tropical forest? I said, oh, yeah, you're right. There is no fish in the tropical forest, huh? I ended up knowing that I did eat cobra snakes. So.
And you liked it, right?
It was exactly like a grilled fish. It was beautiful.
Yeah. I've had snake before. It's really good.
Oh, yeah.
It tastes like eel. Have you had sushi eel?
Yeah. And then it told me, if you feel that you need some of the French Bordeaux wine, oh, we have some. Don't worry, but eat the fish. But, you know, but the idea was that they considered me one of them. And they started to tell me things, even when you're walking, because when we don't have, like, cars all the time, it was one car we exchanged between every two people had one car. And they would tell, no, don't go from that trail. We saw some dangerous animals here. You wouldn't deal with them. There is, you go from that one. Where there is some fighting going here close, go from the, like they started. So I would be comfortable even going from these invitations to where I live, walking, because the people would know me enough to, hi, doctor, and they would protect, no, don't go from here. Pass from that side. Don't do this side. Do all that. So, yeah, it did help a lot. It did help a lot.
What I really like about your story is that it just shows that if you show cultural humility, you gain trust with the people that you're helping, you can really improve their outcomes. And listening to this as a medical student, I'm kind of wondering, how can I, or maybe my peers, or people who are interested in medicine, kind of follow that pathway and show a healthy level of interest and curiosity in the populations and the communities that they'll be working with? How do they gain that trust? So I'm wondering if we can kind of learn from some of your experiences. And one that I wanted to circle back to was the casting that you talked about, where the community would use branches and you said a series of vines and leaves in order to create their own cast. Did they have an aversion to, or was there a lack of access to like normal casting material?
It was both. They don't have access to casting material. And then when you give them something that Western medicine people tell them, you put that powder and put it in water, because the things we had at that time was some powder that you put in water and you kind of like plast it over that part, body, and you let it, and it dries in a minute. And for them, that was something they don't trust. a powder put on their skin that they don't see how it was made, that's something they don't trust. And they don't have access to it anyway. So they had their own thing. And yeah, when they are in the hospital and we talk to them, but then, and the funny thing is later after we built that trust, when I start to have that cast that we did, that powder that we made into, we put water in it and put it on gauze and it becomes a cast, they would accept it. If I am the one telling them, if I tell them, do it, yeah, they would, okay, who told you? And they told him that, oh yeah, he did. Oh yeah, okay, then that's okay, do it.
So how did you find out what their problem was with the cast? You know, for instance, one could have just thought, oh, maybe they just don't want my help. Maybe there's some other reason. How did you find out specifically it was like the powder or the material that they didn't trust?
It's their belief system of not trusting what they want, what they don't know, or what is given to them by people they don't trust. That, I think that was the main thing. The rest was just the how it shows. But the main thing was the way they what they don't know, and something they don't know given to them by people they don't trust, they wouldn't take it. It's just in their belief system. But because it changed when they trusted me, they had no problem using it. And I think the thing you can learn from humility is, as a doctor, when you work, how many nationalities are there in California? And how many languages spoken in the homes of California? And then think about it. You would notice that a doctor from a certain nationality having a clinic in Inland Empire or in Los Angeles or so, funny enough that you see that most of his patients are coming from the exact same ethnic background. Yeah. Do you understand? Like, why? They must have been exposed to other doctors from other nationalities or other ethnic backgrounds. Why would they go to somebody speaking their own home language? From what I see, it's always the fear of that doctor. Of course, they are not afraid that the doctor will harm them, but the fear would be, he will not understand me. He will not understand my problem. He wouldn't give me what I need.
So let me ask you this. Maybe for listeners, I know it's tough because you can't see us here, but maybe you can tell by my voice, I am like the human incarnation of a jar of mayonnaise. What could I do, or maybe other people who are listening, to bridge that gap and to gain the trust of people who maybe do have different backgrounds?
What I found very helpful is start reading about these cultures. What is the norm of their culture? So when you talk to them in the way to make them believe, to make them see that you understand the norm of their culture and the norm of their thinking. For them, this is normal. For them, this is okay. For them, this is not okay. When they understand that, like, I understand you may not like to do so-and-so, but what we can do is this. When they see that you understand their culture, you understand their way of thinking, and you respect it, you don't go with the mindset of, I know you don't listen, you shut up, I'll tell you what to do. You will lose the trust, and they wouldn't come back to you. And that's why they would think of going to somebody speak their own language, because they can speak with the doctor they will. And you notice that they do the chief complaint in the native language, not in English. When they go to the doctor, they don't complain to him in English. They complain in the native language, because it's not about the medical knowledge that person knows. It's about me thinking that he will understand me, understand my problem, and care about me, because he will understand me better. So if you show them that you do that, things in their culture, maybe little, tiny, very, very trivial things, it would make a big difference. They need to know that you know and you care.
Yeah, so like my grandparents, they still go to the same physician that they've gone to since they came to America. And he right now is like a 74-year-old Vietnamese man in Garden Grove. And he still practices every day, like every day, Monday to Friday. Like, I think his office is open like 8 to 6 p.m. But when you walk in there, every single patient is Vietnamese. And not only are they Vietnamese, they're older Vietnamese people, because like, I'm first gen, so like, I don't have to go to a Vietnamese physician, but like everyone that's like over 50, like they're all there, and all of the nurses are Vietnamese, so all of the care that they get is in Vietnamese. And I've gone to one of their appointments with that physician, and he'll say things like, oh, I'm going to prescribe you these like medications, but when you go home, you could have some ginger tea to like soothe your throat or like make your bones feel better. And I know that they really appreciate that, and it really makes them feel like I don't need to leave the medicine that I left in my home country. You know, like I get to have that here and what I came to America for. And it's really nice. And I'm happy that they have someone like him.
From your experience, was there ever a time where you feel like maybe the education and training that you got didn't quite prepare you for like nuanced situations? I guess one thing that comes to mind from a previous discussion was like, there was this time where there were patients who maybe had a higher sensitivity to sedatives. Can you talk more about what that was like and how did you discover that?
The medicine we learned, unfortunately, did not, I don't know, maybe change. Hopefully it's now changing because I see we're doing this, and we, in our time of medical education, we never talked about that stuff. But basically, the education we had was just steps, protocols, facts, and that's what you do, this is what you don't do, and that's it. Like, no other human factors included. And the medicine we learned was very away, for so far away from this cultural sensitivity thing. It was just a solid thing that is done. If he's a human, that's what you do. Okay? But then in there, we were working on a surgery on a lady that was an older lady. First time I got to see this. And in that time, we give anesthesia. We would put just a phenobarbital to put the patient to like sleep for a few minutes, a short acting. And then they give succinylcholine, which will paralyze the muscles, where you can put 4 minutes, where you can put the endotracheal. And then as he breathes back, he will be breathing from anesthesia device, and you will keep him as long as you want. So basically, the process was count to three, and count to three by the time, or count to 10, start counting, and by the time they go to three, they will be off, and that's when you give the succinyl, they start shaking because the acetylcholine is released, and so on. So that was that lady, and the anesthesia guy was not from Angola, but the technician was. The tech that was helping him was Angolian. And basically told the lady, start counting. And she was, un, dos, tres, cuatro. And then you normally go in and do your thing and put your sterile gloves. I put my sterile gloves and came back and she was, 26, 27, 28. I said, whoa. Whoa, stop. Can you increase the dose? I said, what, I'm doing this like with everybody. So the local guy, they tell him, it's mandioca, sir. It's you, double the dose. It's mandioca. And what is it? Just trust me, do it. And then later on, we learned that they don't have access to bread all the time. So they get something from plants, they grind it and mix it with some other stuff. It becomes like a paste they spread over food as a replacement for carbs. But they leave it to ferment. In preparing it, they leave it to ferment, so it have a very appreciable concentration of methyl alcohol. So they have a high tolerance to sedatives. So then we started talking to them and tell them, okay, when you're taking this medicine, there will be no mandioca now. Don't take mandioca for these days you're taking this, please. You can't. And we started to be careful to do lab for their liver because of the methyl alcohol they do. So we started to give them, and we explained to them, I would have given you that medicine, would have been better and faster. But because of the mandioca you eat, your liver is affected, so I have to give you other medicine that go to your kidney. And when they see that, I understand, and I appreciate what they do, and I'm not telling them to stop, I'm telling them, because you do this, I have to do that way. And they appreciated that quite a bit. But I had no idea that, of course, I learned it there.
So I know we keep talking about you being able to integrate their culture with your Western medicine that you're taking there. So what about when you came back to America and you were practicing medicine here and you have patients that want to supplement their health with their alternative medicine? For example, I know we talked about it, but my grandma, when she was in the hospital, like every day she would remind me to bring her the herbal teas that she would make at home. So things like ginseng tea or things like that. Like even when she was in the hospital, like getting all the care she needed and taking the medications she needed, she still wanted her herbal medicine. So how would you advise a patient in America who wants to supplement their health? Like how would you go about that in that patient care setting?
Well, it will depend always on the patient. Like don't force the patient to go on alternative medicine unless the patient give him the offer that there are other natural things. If you don't, especially the best patient to talk about with this will be the patient who, and you will see those a lot, the patients who don't like medicine. There's a lot of, I don't like taking medicine. I don't like medicine. They have something against medicine. Okay, if you don't like to take a lot of medicine, here are some options. And give him these options. And see, but educate yourself to know exactly what you should tell him. These would help. And I want you to take that medicine with it. And those would help. And chances are when the patient sees that you are giving him the option away from medicine, you're broad-minded to accept what he would like, especially like Sabrina was saying, in some population, in some mental zone, in some cultures, and it's not just in Vietnamese, by the way, a lot of people would have that and they wouldn't accept everything the doctor says and they still want those natural things. And up to now, they would prepare it at home and cook it and give it to their kids and so on. Totally. Accept that and tell them, here's how you integrate what you do. If you want to do that, yes, I can give you this medicine to take. The painkillers I can decrease if you're doing this. And then monitor how the response of the body is and how their compliance is. And chances are you're going to get much better compliance. But if you go with the attitude of, no, stop all that nonsense, here's what you do, they will just go to another doctor, that's all.
Can you think of any risks associated with kind of integrating this alternative medicine with like drugs that we're familiar with?
Definitely you have to affiliate yourself with somebody who is a specialist in this to give you some feedback and some education, or you can educate yourself and but definitely you have somebody on board with you who is a specialist in this, educated in this. So you don't just base it on information you read about. You need somebody who is educated on that. And get somebody on your team to be a specialist in that. So you can integrate when it comes to that. Here is the person who is specialized and educated in this. He will tell you what kind of natural remedies you can do. And then when you know that this part is, okay, your medicinal part, because I will not be confident that I would be prescribing something natural if I'm not having official education and degree to give me confidence but I can have somebody who does. I tell them, yes, I can accept. And here is the person who would help you in this. And yeah, you definitely can do that. And they will also see, they will respect it because they will see that you're doing it right. You're not just, okay, he's a doctor. What does he know about natural? Yes, but I have somebody who does.
When I was an undergrad, I worked at a family medicine office. And the physician that I worked with, she was trained in traditional Chinese medicine. So there were a lot of patients that came in and asked specifically for herbal supplements. And I remember she would write like a formula out, and she would write like 20 grams of this and like 80 grams of this. And then I would literally go back into the closet, and it was like all these like different herbs and like their powders. And I would literally weigh it out and then put it into like a bottle and like shake it up and stuff. And that would be the prescription. But it was amazing because there were so many patients that came back for that same prescription because it really worked for them. Because they took it and they felt better, and it would be things like arthritis, or one time actually it was infertility. And my doctor like wrote out this like prescription, and it's in Chinese too. Like I had to match the Chinese characters to like the characters on the bottle. And sometimes I'd like Google cross-translate stuff like that. And then I would mix it, and then the patient came back like 2 months later and was like, I was successful. And I was like, that's really cool. But I obviously don't know anything about it. I just was there for the ride. But it could also just be like the placebo effect, where like they just really trust their physician, and like in their brain, like that's what helps them get to the health that they want to be at.
The placebo effect is very strong. And if your patient trusts you and trusts what you say and trusts that this will make you feel better, and he wants to do what you say, they will probably feel a lot better sooner because part of it is placebo, yes. But again, the only catch is if you want to adopt that in your treatment, just have somebody on board who is educated and professional in doing this so you will feel comfortable referring the patient when it comes to that piece. Here's a person who would help you with it. I'm not dismissing that you can use this, but here's the person who can. And then also think that most of the medicines we got it from natural resources. Some are synthesized, yes, but a lot of the active ingredients that we do are coming from nature.
So where would you say that your priority lies as like a healthcare provider? Like, would you really base it on evidence-based medicine before the holistic care that people want, some people want?
The first goal of any doctor would be patient get better, period. How? It depends on who is the person. I have some basics of stuff we have to do, yes. But then in my experience, of course, mostly that was not very valid a lot of times because in trauma surgery, the patient come in a status that he cannot talk or discuss anything. And, you know, you will go into the mode of give me a knife, leave him for an hour, come pick him up. And that's all you do. But in the interaction with patients, it's not about me feeling good. It's about the patient feeling better. How is the mindset of that human being and how will that human being feel better? How can I get compliance to have him follow a certain regimen that will make him feel better? 100% allopathic medicine or integrate something. It depends on who is the patient. But once it's done right and on the right track on evidence-based medicine, based on science, then yes. But don't get into, close your mind on, it's my way or the highway. Here's how I learned it. You do it that way or you go to that. No, that's not how you treat humans.
Something that I really liked about your story was when you talked about the physician that you worked with in Angola who was able to show you like the crossover between the drugs that you're familiar with and the native remedies that are being used. So I think maybe a separate conversation from that is kind of what Sabrina was saying, where maybe there is no crossover. Maybe it is purely placebo from the beginning. And what I'm curious about is how you feel morally as a physician on the issue of if the end goal is to make the patient feel better, and you've decided that for this patient, if you just go along with it and you tell them, yes, this tea that should have no pharmacological merit at all, maybe would help them with something that they're concerned about. Because you know that at an emotional or spiritual level, it's what they need at that moment. Contrasting that with what your expectations are maybe with using evidence-based medicine in your practice, how do you reconcile that to help the individual?
Well, it's sometimes hard, but there is basics you don't cross, which is you don't tell him about something to be helpful if there is no evidence that it would be. That's not correct. And in the same time, if you know it wouldn't hurt, you just tell him it wouldn't help you, but it wouldn't hurt if that makes you feel better. But when it comes to that reconciliation part, I would definitely go to the point of having somebody on the team. And we, after I came back from Angola and went back and practiced with the Germans, and the Germans have, some of them have that trend to accept natural medicine. So we had somebody on the team who is a professional in herbs and natural medicine and so on. So, okay, I'll refer you right now to meet him. He's in the other room. Go see him. He will give you the stuff you can use and the remedies. Yes, what you're saying makes sense. I'll have him tell you exactly in details and you come back to me. I'll give you. And they would tell me that to replace that you can decrease painkiller with this. You can decrease the colic and diarrhea with that. And then do the rest of it. Then I know exactly to just how to explain to him those natural medicine that you accepted will be good. It will help you. But here is the things that I still want you to do. And you can do these. So it's not what I think. I have an evidence based of what help and what does not help. You know, so the key is always have somebody who is, unless you get that degree yourself.
So what we were just talking about is the scenario where there's a patient who wants to supplement their care with alternative medicine. Something that I'd like to talk to you about as well is the scenario where a patient actually declines their care and only is interested in using alternative medicine. And specifically, there's an interesting story that I heard of from a peer of mine who was shadowing in a neurosurge unit. Basically, a patient had a brain aneurysm that was about to rupture, and they denied the care. They said they only believed in their alternative medicine. They wanted to use herbal tea, and they believed that the herbal tea would help them. What can you do as a physician in that scenario?
Well, if he declines, you cannot force him, evidently, but you see if there is, first, you will see if there is any power of attorney on that patient that you can discuss with them. And if not, there is no allowance, like he didn't allow anybody to speak for him, then you will raise it to the ethics committee and they will.
So for people who are maybe not familiar, what's the role of a power of attorney in a hospital setting?
A power of attorney is when the patient is not able to decide for himself, or the patient is in a status of health or mind that may not make him fit. He may not be fit to decide for himself. And there is a power of attorney for a family member or so. Then that family member will be the decision maker in that case. So you would go to him and tell him, he's saying this is too dangerous, and then you have to have that power of attorney. If not, you cannot touch him.
And when you say that a patient is not in the state of mind to be making these medical decisions, who decides if a patient's not coherent? Because for me, listening to the story, I'm thinking, if you have a brain aneurysm that is imminently going to rupture, a reasonable person would say, yes, please talk to me about what treatments are available.
Yeah, but then if you're in doubt, what you would do is you go get a consult and have this guy checked to see if the psychiatric people or the psychiatric people tell you, yeah, his thinking, content, and process is linear and logical, that you can't do anything if that. But then there is always the legal team in the hospital and the ethics committee tell him, okay, here's what I... But you're not going to be a hero, and now you don't know what you... Okay, if there's a power of attorney, that's something else. In our case, in trauma units or like bad traumas like this, you have the right to intervene and save the patient, because the patient in trauma surgery, normally the patient is not in a state most of the time to say what's good for him. So when we get the patient, he's about to die, he's bleeding, he's alone, and okay, then it's up to me now to do the best I know to save him. But then when he gets back and he can talk and he can think of what, and I ask him, here's what we have and here's what we still need to do, then it's up to him to decide. Okay, and you're protected legally when you are in the zone of patient is coming in a trauma that he cannot, and he's alone, there's nobody talk for him, and he's not in a state to talk or decide, and he's between life and death. It's up to you to intervene.
So something that you mentioned was the ethics team. Can you just explain what is the ethics team? When do they get involved, and how does their decision
ethics
influence care?
Ethics team normally in the hospital will be involved in situations like this. They have attorneys, they have medical professionals in management positions, and they have legal people, and they would tell you, medical legal professionals, that they will tell you what you can and cannot do. And basically that is to protect you, because so you don't get a malpractice lawsuit out of trying to be a hero with somebody. So you need to get the guide of these guys.
And I kind of want to talk about this more, actually. So that time frame kind of sounds like a long time, like having to go through power of an attorney or like the ethics team. So if it was something like this, where it was a brain aneurysm that really had a risk of rupture, like, and there's really not a lot of time or any time that you know of, is that a time when you're protected and you can make your own decisions as a physician?
From what I know, thankfully I didn't get into situations like this, but from what I know, if the patient is coherent and can decide for himself, you cannot force him to. But if he comes to you with the aneurysm ruptured or his altered state of mind, and there's no family members with you and he is unconscious, and there is a ruptured aneurysm or it's leaking, yeah, you can interfere. It's your duty. But I'm not a lawyer, and happily I am not, that because I wouldn't do I wouldn't do good in law, but
yeah, I don't think I would either.
It's just, yeah, as I told you, in the trauma surgery, we have that mindset. When it's ugly, get me a knife, leave the patient, come pick him up in an hour, you'll be fine.
So in this specific case, it sounds like the patient wasn't saying that they never at any point want medical care. It sounds like what they were saying was that they believe that their herbal treatment would make it so that they don't need medical care. Based on that type of conversation, if they were to have that aneurysm rupture, can the physicians operate? What kind of considerations would go through your head if you were to decide to treat the patient at that point?
It's not about consideration. Normally, in this case, you would get a discussion with the patient and with somebody who is professional in herbal medicine and tell him, we cannot treat aneurysm with what you know in herbal medicine. And it's not because of me, an allopathic doctor, do that. No, an herbal medicine specialist told you that. If not, then have the patient write a statement or have a statement and he will sign it. Do you or do you not? If he, in signature, in document, declined, you can't. It's the same as Jehovah Witness come in bleeding and they have in the record they cannot take blood. You can't give him blood. The only protection of documentation you do that I saw when I was reviewing clinical documentation is that the doctor make a mistake. A mistake of the doctor would be they did not document in the patient document that patient is a Jehovah Witness and declined blood. And there is a code in the clinical document. There is a code for that. Treatment cannot be given due to patient belief or other conditions. If you don't put that code, then they will come after you. What is wrong with you? Patient was bleeding and you didn't treat him wrong. That's a malpractice. No, I did not. The patient was a Jehovah's Witness. I could. Well, it's not in the record. It did not happen. If it's not in the record, it doesn't exist. If it's not on the medical record, it does not exist.
Now, could that same scenario go the other way, where they did provide the blood transfusion, but there was previous documentation that they were Jehovah's Witness? And how would that scenario kind of shape out for the physician?
That would be an ugly legal situation. And a lot of times when I was doing the clinical documentation, I would go to the doctors and tell them, we would write something like a form, special form, a query form. You did this, you wrote this, you did not write this. And a lot of times when we were talking to that, they wouldn't believe, like they don't know it. But doctor, that's not a diagnosis. Why would I? Calm down. And I explained to them, if it's not on the record, it does not exist. This guy came to you with a fractured femur. Fracture femur, his hemoglobin, when he started, was 11. A day and a half later, his hemoglobin is now 8.5. The common question, why don't you give him blood? Where's the Jehovah's Witness? It's not in the record, then it does not exist. It will be on you. You have to tell me why you gave fluids and didn't give blood. If it's not on the document, it does not exist.
All right, so we talked about a lot of things today, ranging from eating snake to embracing diverse cultural views to just enhance patient outcomes. I was kind of hoping we could end on a positive note with this conversation, and what I'm looking for is, do you have any kind of moral to the story that maybe you could share with the next generation of listeners who are maybe interested in medicine or currently med students, or maybe they're already practicing? What can we do?
Well, I'm not the wise man that should be saying that, but what I learned from my experience in war surgery was I learned some very unexpected things from very unexpected situations. At the end of it was I learned to respect nature. I learned to respect human beings because they are human beings only. And I got the concept from there after I learned so many things from these people who even spoke a language that I don't even understand, but I learned a lot of things from them. What I saw was every human being you meet in your life will have a lot to teach you. It's your mindset to accept to learn or refuse to learn because you think you know enough or you know better. And that's your problem, not their problem. But if you have the correct mindset, each human being you will meet will have a lot of experiences, a lot of knowledge that you don't know and you can learn. You just need to open your mind and listen with an open mind and open heart and you will learn. Humans are humans. And I always used to think that, oh yeah, medicine, I know the medicine, I know the protocols, but when I got back from there and saw how much things I learned, and even on the human level, how to respect nature. They read nature, they understand it, they smell it, they are so good at it, and I found myself so ignorant about it. But then when you start to see this as a doctor, you have to open your mind to the fact that you are helping human beings to be better, to feel better. And that will be psychologically, emotionally, and physically. And you cannot do that without understanding where they come from before they got to you. Your life crossed when they saw you as a doctor or a patient relationship. But who are they? They are human beings. They have fears. All of us have fears. We just express it differently. All of us have hopes, have frustrations. But we express it differently. We think of it differently. And we talk about it in different languages. But humans are humans. And inside the skin, you all know we all look alike. So when you get to that field, it's a very blessed field that you get the privilege of helping humans to feel better. But you just need to respect them as they are. Learn about people as much as you can. Learn about their cultures, about the way they think, about their norms. Don't judge it to be right or wrong. It's not your job. Your job is when you approach him, you will approach him from the mental zone he's at. So you can better help him to be a better person. And then you will feel a lot of satisfaction when people really feel better and be thankful for it.
Dr. Mashriki, thank you so much for having us today. I really enjoyed listening to your story. I found it personally very inspirational and motivating. Hopefully for those of you who are listening, you can resonate with some elements of the story as well. Great to have you. I hope we can have you again sometime for some more of your stories. For those of you listening, thank you for listening to another episode of Our Untangled Minds, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you have any questions, comments, or episode suggestions, please email us at oumpodcast@cusm.org. That's oumpodcast@cusm.org.